Matt Segundo here, and so begins part two of our very thorough, I suppose, Book Expo coverage. Excuse me while I dodge the party poppers and pop open the champagne. While I'm not particularly impressed by the respect afforded to our young loving correspondent, I am under an obligation to describe his labor. This podcast finds him talking to a number of publishers, and even a newspaper book editor who proved more receptive than a certain dour man operating in New York. Personally, I refuse to set foot in that mammoth city, or any locale named New Anything. I mean, why does nobody contemplate the original York? Instead, these impatient upstarts have to apply a new label for their petty city. Well, I've got news for you, callow hipsters. Old is the new black.
Okay, I am here with the ubiquitous Chad Post, who we're here in the Melville House booth. Chad, so what makes you so ubiquitous? And maybe you can talk about Dalkey Archive a bit.
No, I'm not sure what makes me so ubiquitous. I think mainly because I just walk around a lot through the show and know a lot of people and get introduced to various people. But in terms of Dalkey, like things are going very well for Dalkey Archive right now. As you know, you came to our party last night for Reading the World, which is a big...
Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
You sure that was me?
I know you were there. Things are going great for Dalkey, and part of it is because of Reading the World. It's this program, for anyone who doesn't know, where a bunch of publishers, 10 publishers and 200 bookstores, work together to display international literature during the month of May. And last night we had a party at the French Embassy, which you were at, which I hope you enjoyed.
Sure, that was me.
Maybe it was you, maybe it wasn't. But it was a great party with a lot of support from the French Embassy, from the Polish Embassy, from the Croatian Embassy. All the different countries got together. And generally what happens with the program, what is happening, what's great, is that it's becoming more communal and that people are working together to try and find readers and get people interested in international literature. And it's fantastic.
Would you say that Reading the World so far, from your perspective, from Dalkey's perspective, has been a success? Has this really leveraged, to use marketing buzz here, because that's what BEA is all about, leveraged the sort of platform in favor of translated literature?
It has. It definitely has. I got stories last night. I finally had the chance to talk to a number of booksellers who participated, who each one of them had a different story of a different customer who came to international literature because of Reading the World. And it's helped us, aside from like these specific books that are part of the program and these specific different bookstores, overall, our sales are increasing for translated fiction. And I think that has to do with the fact that we're doing this program, that we're really creating some sort of buzz. And people like you, everyone that's doing a little something to try and bring attention to this, fact that there is international literature, not everything's American, is helping. People are reading this and people are loving it and they're getting more.
Maybe for those who haven't sampled any of the Reading the World titles, if you had to pick just one, and I know you're still sort of stacked the deck for Dalkey, but you know, let's go ahead and give you an honest answer. What is the Reading the World book to read out of the bowl?
The one that I'm picking is Maddie Unt's Things in the Night, which is a Dalkey book, but
I have to.
And it's an Estonian author who died last year. It's a brilliant book, like one of the most beautiful, interesting books I've ever read. And there's actually an article in Context magazine online that is all about this book and about Maddie Unt, which would give you a very good background on reading it. But it's a beautiful book. It begins with a guy who says that he's going to write a book about electricity. He's been promising to write a book about electricity for years, which is like saying you're going to write a book about life. Like there's no way that you can do that. And then it goes from there.
The other thing we should probably discuss is this whole sort of multiple badges thing. Again, sort of playing up with this ubiquitous quality.
Yeah, that's my other ubiquitous fact, because I have two badges. I have a press badge for Context, and I also have a badge because I'm going to be giving a panel, moderating a panel today on Reading the World and International Fiction. And so the second badge, someone needs a badge, so I'm going to go pick up this badge, give that to them, and there'll be two Chad Posts.
Yeah. Really? Are you sure there aren't two of me?
There's two Ed champions.
There's only one Bat Segundo, though, if you go to the LBC party tonight.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Chad.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. This is an addendum to the chat post interview. He apparently has a story that he needs to tell us.
I have two stories. They tie together.
Oh, two. Well, I should just stick here and you'll get five.
Okay, yeah. We'll go to 3, 4 as we go along here. But the last night at the party, Robert Sindler from Third Place Books was there. And he came up and talked to me at the end about how things are going with the Reading the World display. And he said that it's been fantastic this year. They have pictures of the different countries. People are just browsing, picking up these books. They're very interested and excited about it. But then he also told me that they recently hired this young girl who's 19 years old, who is like her first job in a bookstore, and they usually don't hire people that young. And it turns out, like, she saw the display and she started talking to him and saying, oh, you know, I'm glad that you guys are doing this again, because last year I got the brochure and I've read every book except for two of them. So she came to the bookstore essentially because she fell in love with the Reading the World books and started reading all of them and has been collecting them and was excited about this whole program. So he said that, you know, just because of that, because now she's like a very good employee, very well read and interested and excited, like the Reading the World program has affected people and is working. Now my story that to his was that the reason I like it is that when I was at the ALTA conference, the American Literary Translators Association, I was having dinner and there's this very attractive woman that I kept noticing, and she'd look over every once in a while and like didn't think anything of it. And as I was walking out, she came up to me and said, are you Chad Post? I said, yeah, you know, I am. She's like, oh, I've been wanting to meet you since I saw this Reading the World display in City Lights last year. So there are attractive women coming up to see you and people becoming good bookstore employees. It's a perfect program.
So you're really in this for the chicks then.
Isn't that what book selling is all about? I mean,
I guess.
Yeah.
Matt Segunda has groupies too. All right, Jay, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, the man behind Melville House Books and also a fellow podcaster of Moby Lives Radio. Dennis, how you doing?
Hi, Ed. You look a lot different from last year.
Really?
Yeah.
Less hair, probably.
Where'd you get that tattoo on your forehead?
Oh, well, you know, the government sort of issued it. The NSA actually went ahead and just put it there because they figured they could just, like, get it straight from my head, rather, because I don't use the phone all that much.
I thought I recognized that microphone.
So I noticed that you have actually, A.C. Thompson has a book out with you, and he actually writes for my hometown Alt-Weekly, San Francisco Bay Garden. Maybe you can tell me about that.
That's right. He also just won the George Polk Award for the writing he's doing, reporting about people like you, looking into people like you and your misdeeds and what you're doing to the Great Bay Area and how you're ruining life out there. And so we're very proud to be publishing him. This book, he's actually, it's called The Torture Taxi. He's writing about the CIA's torture and rendition program, and that beautiful cover that Ed is looking at right now, Ed's audience, I can't really seem to make him look at me. He's looking at this cover because it's so striking. It's a picture of the CIA's airplane, where the plane, the actual plane that is the torture taxi, whereby they take people from Nevada to North Carolina to Ireland to parts unknown and torture them.
Well, what's the situation with dog barking and some of your other titles?
The Dog Barking is a book about diagramming, which is a grammatical breakdown system used by generations past, although still in place at some points. It's called Sister Bernadette and the Barking Dog, and it's about the history of diagramming a sentence. It's a pure language book. It's about the basics of grammar and parsing sentences.
And you have a very large Starbucks coffee here, sir, so if you're talking about people like me.
Yeah, Starbucks. It's the only coffee available here in Washington, apparently, in our nation's capital.
Yeah, I've noticed that, too.
The Starbucks lobby is triumphant here in Washington.
And about this conversations with Mr. Prawn, which I haven't yet read yet, but tell me this about this.
You know, Mr. Prawn would have been an equally interesting title now that you mention it. This is a first novel, but not a first book. The author is a New Zealander living in England who is a classical religions scholar, ancient religions scholar, has written numerous incredibly expensive textbooks, and we asked her to write an incredibly expensive novel. She failed, so we only have this very reasonably priced novel of hers, but it's a wonderful kind of an intellectual mystery.
By expensive or expansive?
It's both inexpensive but expansive, yes.
So you actually got an inexpensive, expansive novel and not an expensive novel.
I'm sorry, I lost track of that after the first EX.
No, okay.
What was your name again?
My name was Ginger, actually.
That's Ginger. That explains the heels.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, no, I mean, you said you had commissioned a novel from her that didn't quite pan out. I mean, maybe you can.
No. I'm just kidding that she couldn't write something. She writes textbooks that go for $180, and we were trying to figure out if there was a way we could market a novel for $180, and we were unable to do it. So we have to market it at the normal price.
Well, why not? There's that Muhammad Ali book from last year.
What's that?
The Muhammad Ali book. It would cost something like $2,000 or something, and it had all those like testimonials from Updike and the like.
Yeah, it's true. My bet is it didn't go into a second printing, though.
No, I bet that, too.
Yeah.
Do you have any other books that you're hawking here? Or?
Ed, I'm nothing but books that I'm hawking here. You know, there's a couple others that your listeners in particular might be interested in. We're doing a book that's a memoir by Andre Chiffrin. Andre Chiffrin comes from a great publishing family in France. They discovered Gide. They published the Pléiades series. They had to flee France for America, where they started all over again. He went on to be the publisher of Pantheon, which was taken over by Random House. He was the publisher of Pantheon for 30 years, and he finally quit in protest of the conglomerate ownership. This is a big event here in New York City in 1990, when all these writers from around the world came to protest in front of the Random House building with Andre Chiffrin. He is now the publisher of the New Press, and we are doing his memoir with him. It's a great story about becoming an intellectual leftist publisher. He is also the guy who, when he was in college, was the head of his college's. He was at Yale, and he was the head of the college's leftist political club, which he renamed the Students for a Democratic Society. So he is the founding father, in a way, of the SDS as well. So this is a great book about publishing, about leftist intellectualism, and modern American leftism, and we're really excited about that one.
And we should also note that he also invented Silly Putty too.
He did, but he doesn't like that to get around. People leave Silly Putty in bad places and on furniture and things like that, and it can cause stains.
Gotcha. Well, Dennis, thank you so much.
Oh, Ed, it's always a pleasure, and really, I do know a doctor can help you with that tattoo.
With your pen and notebook, you've blown me away. It's the smallest words we cannot say.
Hi, I'm here with Laura Kellner, who is at the Moleskine booth, but the Moleskine presence is noticeably diluted compared from last year. What's going on?
That's right. Well, what the Italians wanted us to show the new city guides, and they're very invested in it, so they really wanted us to only talk about city guides, but it's impossible because people want to talk about Moleskine in general, and so we're doing that out as well. Just to tell you about the city guides, the first year will be all European cities. And then in 2000 and late 07 will be the U.S. cities. And I'm sure you can't see this on the podcast.
We'll describe it. Let's go over this here.
What it comes with is the map. This is the Paris guide. And it's got your map. And then some city street guide. Blank pages to put notes in, and then it comes in sections where essentially they're saying you can write your best travel guide, and they have it in all these different sections, and it's got some more notes, and then a place for you to you made a nice Parisian, here's my number, I'm staying at this hotel. And then a really fun feature are these tracing paper pages that can go directly over the map, so you can write on the map and make your own notes, places that you'd like to go. So that's coming out in October 2007. Also, I'd like to promote the planners. There's seven new 2007 planners, two 18-month planners that are starting in July with a softback cover. The layout is a week on a page here, and then blank pages on the other side. And again, the usual Moleskine pocket, romantic story in the back, acid-free paper, the elastic band.
So it seems to me that by not having the other Moleskines, you're moving more into city guides and planners, or at least this is the presence you want to sort of portray this year?
Well, we're the U.S. distributor, and we actually wanted to show the whole line, but this they came from Italy. Yeah. The Moleskine is from Italy, and they insisted they sent this in a box. We took it out, and they insisted that we do the city guides at the show. The stationery show is going on at the same time right now in New York, where we're promoting the whole line and the planners a little bit stronger at that show. So, yeah, unfortunately, we don't have all the displays here of all the books, but we do have them hidden in this. If somebody needs to see them, we've got them.
Now, I'm wondering if this cost cutting may have something to do with the recent announcement that the founder wants to sell the company off to a reliable sort of person? Or?
Well, mostly they are working on a 3-year plan. If we just found out ourselves that they're selling the company, but we don't, you know, have much comment on that. We don't really know the details. But of course, it's something that they think will be a big seller over, you know, the next couple of years, and they're investing a lot of money into the city guides. Everything will stay the same as far as regular Moleskines go. It's just they're trying to do a big push for this. So no cost cutting, really. They're actually putting a lot of money into it.
Do you think that they'll be able to keep up with the growing demand? Because Moleskine consistently sort of has a presence, and more people are interested in Moleskine. So will mass production sort of curtail like the quality of the product?
No, I don't think so. The quality is number one with Moleskine. It won't be the good product that it is if it doesn't have the smooth writing paper. That's what keeps people. The story has been great. But after a while, it really comes down to the actual product, and as you know, it's got a really good cult following. And if you change from that, they know better. They know that it has to stay this way. Gotcha. And it's just when you have a successful thing, you try new things. The city guides are fun. They are kind of exciting, and it could be a new good adventure for them.
What cities are you doing first for the city guides?
Well, Paris, London, and Rome for start, and then also Vienna, Montreal, let's see.
San Francisco, hooray.
Yeah, and the next year will be the U.S. cities, Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, New York, San Francisco, Washington, and then, of course, Montreal and Canada.
Are these where Moleskine are the top sellers? Are you hitting a specific sort of areas in these cities? I mean, what were these? What made these cities the sort of like initial kind of Moleskine city guide run?
Probably bookstores with good travel sections will have the city guides, and the stores that carry the city guides will have to take the whole program, which is an assortment of about 48 pieces, and they will all advertise on Moleskinery.com, the world-renowned fan site for Moleskine, and again, it's moleskinery.com, and you can find out your retailer for these notebooks on that site.
Well, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, I'm here with Judith Recky of Merriam-Webster, who is going to tell me all about their exciting dictionaries that they actually have. What's new on the dictionary front?
Well, the big event of this year is the 200th anniversary of the first American dictionary, which was created by Noah Webster in 1806. So we're going to have a few events in the booth during BEA, Book Expo America, and we're also going to be doing some press and publicity later in the year as well.
Do you have a special edition coming out for the 200 years, or what's the situation?
No, we don't, but we have our most recent collegiate dictionary, which is the 11th edition. The most current copyright is 06, and so we're going to be emphasizing press and publicity with that.
Can you give me a scoop on like what words are sort of rejected from your dictionaries and what words actually make it in? Is there a criteria that you could share?
Well, actually, the lexicographers make their own choices. It isn't something like there's a panel with a black and a white marble. They make their own intelligent decision as to what goes in, what comes out. Obviously, if there's new technology, we have to take some words out that may be archaic or are dealing with old technology. So it's a group effort, very much a group effort.
Now, what's the sort of slang percentage in Merriam-Webster dictionaries, would you say?
Well, Coming from sales, I don't know if I can give you the percentage on the numbers on that one. But if a word is in carefully edited prose, in text, if something occurs in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, then it's eligible to be included in the Collegiate Dictionary.
Do sales and publicity have any kind of influence over the Merriam-Webster Dictionary at all? Or?
Influence, no. It's well, we can say what we want for sure, but it's a product of scholarship, and we very much like that sales handle because we always are able to say that it's a product of scholarship.
Now, are there any sort of like headhunters at Merriam-Webster who might sort of like, you know, influence the direction of that scholarship? Or?
Well, we certainly have our president and publisher, who's been with us now 25 years. He came up through editorial. For those of us in sales, he caught on to the business aspects way too fast. So yes, in that he is the president and publisher, he does influence it. And again, it's his vision for the company.
What I'm wondering, though, is that has he ever rejected a word because it just doesn't sell or something? Or?
Oh, not because it doesn't sell. Sometimes we make not popular decisions for what's included. For instance, the word ain't is in the dictionary, and if we were dealing in a censorship environment, people might suggest we take that out, but it's in carefully edited prose, and if it is, then it goes in the dictionary.
So ain't has generated a lot of controversy?
Well, it did a few years ago, but again, we just report the language as it is used. We don't censor it.
Are there any other sort of words that are objected to that you've included in Merriam-Webster?
Let me put it this way. There are always words someone will object to.
Well, thanks so much, Judith. Okay, so I'm here with Eleanor Herman, who is dressed in a very regal outfit, who is an author, too. Maybe you can tell us about what book you have and why the whole getup here. Does it take, you know, queen costumes to sort of sell books these days? Or?
I think the queen costume helps. This is my second book. It's called Sex with the Queen. It's nonfiction, and it looks at queens' love affairs. It's a follow-on book to my first one, which came out 2 years ago and was called Sex with Kings. And it looked at the history of royal mistresses going back several hundred years and ends up with Camilla Parker Bowles. And I find that when I do book signings, or I like to give a lot of lectures as well, wearing the costume generates a lot of interest, and it's also educational because it shows people what these women had to look like every day of their lives, and they had to change their gown 7-8 times a day. So you would wear one for mass, and another one for breakfast, and another one if you were going to walk in the gardens, and then a ball gown at night. And I think about half of their time was just spent putting on and taking off these beautiful clothes.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. What is the sort of salacious to historical ratio in both of these volumes?
You know, there's very little sex, I would say. It's about people who had sex that weren't supposed to. Most of the details about the actual sex, I think if there were letters, they've been burned. I mean, I did find a few things. But it's mostly about politics and intrigue and human choices. That's what it's about.
One would argue that sex is nothing but politics.
Sex was used for politics. The sex wasn't ever really a big deal, but people would use it to wield more political power or to get rid of somebody that they didn't like. They would make an accusation of sexual misconduct. It was never about the sex, it was always about the politics.
Could you cite an example from one of your books that you might want to go into? Or?
Yes, a very interesting one would be Anne Boleyn, very famous queen of England, Henry VIII's second wife. And her husband listened to the courtiers' inventions that she was adulterous. She was not. But many courtiers were upset with Anne. She was a nasty person. She had taken away all of their jobs and given them to her family and friends. She was changing the political stance of England to be more towards France and against their traditional ally of Spain. And she was also changing their religion. So she had to go. And when she didn't give Henry a son, people planted this idea in his head that, you know, she's adulterous, and he was looking at her lady-in-waiting for queen number three anyway, so they chopped off her head. It was not about sex. There was no adulterous sex. It was about the politics.
Gotcha. Well, Eleanor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Big nasty lady at my side. Santa Ana winds blowing hot from the north. We were born to ride.
I'm here with David Yulin, the recently appointed editor. Well, how recent is this? For
7.5 months.
7.5 months. That's recent enough.
Recent enough. Yeah, less than a year, right? You're still on your honeymoon.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, he's the editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review. So, David, have you scanned? Have you scoured any particular galleys that are sort of worthwhile, or have you been over information overload? Has this kicked in yet?
It hasn't kicked in yet because I've only been here for about 3 hours, but it's starting to. I've seen, what have I seen that looks interesting? Well, this Paco Ignacio Taibo Subcommander Marcos book that Akashic is putting out looks interesting to me. I just grabbed a copy of that. And the other thing that looks really interesting is Harvey Pekar is editing. Houghton Mifflin is starting a Best American Comics anthology to go with the rest of their Best Americans. And I guess Harvey Pekar is co-editing the initial version, so I grabbed a galley of that. That looks like it could be a fascinating thing, too. I'm very interested in the idea of making comics more central to the culture or embracing them as central to the culture.
Well, 7.5 months into the LA Times Book Review run, do you think you've got, you know, the hang of things now, or...?
The hang of things in the sense that I no longer worry every Monday morning whether we're going to put a section out on Sunday. I think the kind of the pragmatic aspects of it, which were all there in place anyway, I feel like I've learned the practical aspects of, you know, the mechanical aspects of how we put this thing out. As far as where we want to go with the review, we're just starting out in terms of what we want to do with it.
Are you going to pull any stunts like, say, naming the sort of contemporary fiction since 1980 list or anything like that? Or are you going to keep things like, you know, actually covering fiction year-round? You know?
I think we'll cover fiction year-round.
Do you fear the wrath of Mark Sarvis, who does take the LA Times Book Review to task from time to time?
I don't fear Mark. I know Mark. In fact, I just saw him somewhere over that direction. I think free-spirited, open conversation is all of what it's about. So, I mean, what any kind of commentary, pro or con, obviously I prefer the pro, just means is people are reading it and thinking about it. And both the section and the books, the most important thing is really the books.
I have to say, though, I'm glad that you talked with me because I can't seem to get an interview out of Tannen House. So the Los Angeles people actually talk with interviewers.
Well, I can't, you know, I'll just speaking for myself, I'm always happy to talk to you guys because I think, you know, I just, again, it's all about the books. So I'm glad to talk about the books and glad to be part of the conversation about them.
How are you going to tie in your Book Expo experience into the LA Times Book Review?
It depends. I mean, what I usually, I come to this thing a lot. I mean, I've come... can't remember how many times, but many times. And what's different for me being here as part of the Times as opposed to as a freelancer is that I'm seeing almost all of the stuff from major publishers. So my main purpose here really is to touch base with people I know, obviously, but also to kind of search out the stuff I'm not seeing, which I've been doing a little bit, and also kind of connect with writers if I see them or just sort of, you know, see who... There's always a serendipitous aspect to this thing, as always, as would happen when you get 30,000 people together in a room. So it's more of an... It's hard to say in terms of actual pragmatics. You know, I'm sure I'll bring home a dozen or 25 books that we'll want to look at for the review that I wouldn't have known about otherwise. That would be the most practical aspect. But beyond that, I think just part of being part of the community, part of passing the review around, I brought a bunch of the most recent issue and just sort of being here and part of it.
Well, thanks so much, David. Okay, so I am here with Kerry Goldstein of FSG, and he's going to talk to me about some of the upcoming titles that are coming up. What's going on?
What's going on? We have lots of great fiction this season. Alice McDermott's got a new novel out. We have a strong debut collection by a young African-American writer named Asali Solomon, Get Down. The story has to take place in Philadelphia. We've got Doug Marlette's novel. Doug's a Southern cartoonist and novelist. And we have a lot of hopes for that. Those are the galleys we have out. Lots of really strong nonfiction. We've got a memoir collection of episodic pieces by Jonathan Franzen, The Discomfort Zone. A strong book by Nick Lemon, New Yorker writer, on the last battle of the Civil War, really the, it's called the 10 years following what's traditionally considered the end of the Civil War, and what happened there, and that's in fact when the Civil War ended. On our Faber list, we've got The Diaries of Courtney Love. High hopes for that. But probably one of the things we're most excited about is on our Hill and Wang imprint, we've got a graphic adaptation of the 9/11 Commission Report, and I think that's already stirring up a lot of controversy and attention and excitement, and it's one of the books that I'm personally most excited about on the list.
Yeah. I've also got a book actually by National Journal writer Peter Stone on Jack Abramoff, lobbyist scandal. I think that'll also do really well for us. And there's a lot more, but those are some of the highlights that I think of off the top of my head.
What about translated novels? You were pushing those big time last year, and I know that we're going back to Americana, it looks like, with this year.
Yeah, well, we've always got stuff. I mean, on our FSG Classics list, we're reissuing some stuff. The FSG Classics is different than something like Penguin Classics, which just publishes World Classics. FSG Classics are books that came from FSG originally. And so some of the new books on the Classics this year include The Old Gringo, Carlos Fuentes, Yasunari Kawabata, Palm of the Hand Stories, William Golding's Darkness Visible, and James Salter's Sport and a Pastime. And other books in translation on that list are Frederick Prokosh's The Asiatics. I'm trying to think of the stuff in translation here. I mean, we're always publishing, reissuing new Isaac Singer. Gimple the Fool, in this case, we also got a biography of Isaac Singer by a French woman named Florence Neuville. And that's been under contract for a long time. We're really excited about that.
In terms of like new fiction translated,
there's no new fiction that I can think of in translation. But as you know, we published quite a bit over the past year. There is a wonderful, you'd actually personally be interested in, it's a wonderful memoir, what the French call auto-fiction. So it's sort of a loosely, more creatively constructed memoir. It's a lot of fun by a French writer named Grégoire Bouillet. It's never been published in English before. And it's called The Mystery Guest. And that's going to be a lot of fun. That's a short, compact book. This guy, you want to hear what it's about? It's a wonderful story. This guy, one day this guy, Grégoire, and his girlfriend were sitting in a cafe. His girlfriend, can you give me like 5 minutes? This guy and his girlfriend were sitting in a cafe. She was a budding journalist, and they saw a journalist that they both knew sitting across the cafe, and he encouraged her, go introduce yourself. So she gets up, introduces herself, sits down with him, and then 2 hours later they get up, and they walk out of the cafe and out of Grégoire's life forever, without even saying goodbye, just gone. 5 years later, he gets a phone call from this girl, not to say I'm sorry, not to ask how he is, but to invite him to a party where he's going to be a bit of the performance piece called The Mystery Guest. And this is the book, and so it all takes place on like the evening of this party and the days leading up to it. It's sort of book about obsession and being stuck and unsticking. It's really great.
So, but going back to this issue of like moving away from sort of foreign novels or translated novels.
Moving away from it, there's some great, this season we're publishing tons of great stuff in translation. Happens to be that on the fall list there isn't necessarily stuff, but on the winter list there will be. So it's not moving away, it's about finding the right work. You don't just publish to publish. We're FSG, we publish.
Of course.
What's appropriate.
I'm just wondering if your strategy had sort of changed or shifted back to like, more sort of like Franzen and 9/11 things.
Absolutely not. This season we published Rodrigo Frazan. We've got two of Roberto Bolaño's classic novels, the big ones, coming up. In fact, one of them is going to be coming up in the spring, I want to say. Winter or spring. So there's some pretty exciting stuff coming down the line. We've been publishing Ha Jin over the past few years. Edgar Corret's book, The Nimrod Flipout, is out right now. It's done really well for us. So, yeah, we're pretty committed to finding new voices. And, in fact, this book by Bouillet, this French book, is the first book translated from the French for FSG in quite a while. So,
now, the Prokosh book, I'm a big fan of Frederick Prokosh, actually. And I was wondering how you stumbled upon him, because most of his stuff is like out of print now. And
the FSG Classics are books that were first published by FSG. So it's something that we're reprinting and republishing precisely because he needs an audience.
Yeah. Are you going to publish republish The Seven Who Fled or any of the Missolonghi manuscript?
These are all, I don't know that we published those in the first place, so it's not like that we would have the rights for it. So these, as I said, these books are our books that originated with us and that came from FSG and that are staples of the house, books that kind of made FSG what it is.
Are the FSG Classics going to have like introductions or any supplemental stuff?
A lot of them do. Not all of them do, but some of them do, yeah. Off the top of my head, I can't think of who, but there are really some great ones. Like, I'll tell you right now, if I give you an example.
I could recommend one for the Prokosh. Gore Vidal did a very good essay for him. So.
Well, it's already out, so I think it's a little too late.
Yeah.
But yeah, they do. Some of them do have translations. I mean, introductions.
And translations.
And translations.
We would hope so, anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Kerry.
Absolutely, it was good to see you. Yeah.
I am here at the McSweeney's booth with the one, the only Eli Horowitz, who is the editor and I suppose kind of all-purpose person. What is your official title, sir?
I'm officially managing editor. We need to move farther away from these guys. It's too embarrassing.
Oh, okay.
I am managing editor of McSweeney's.
Okay.
And you've taken on books that are a little bit grittier, I've noticed, for the people of paper. Yannick Murphy's Here They Come. What do you have up the pipeline, and what would you say is your sort of editorial style?
We really don't think in any kind of ideological way about what we're seeking out. We just sort of, it's the obvious thing of just books that excite us and we respond to. So maybe I'm turning grittier as a person. I recently moved to the Mission from Berkeley, so maybe I live on Cap Street, so maybe I'm attracted to those things in life now.
I note that you haven't shaved today, so.
I haven't shaved in a couple days.
Yeah.
I'm an extremely gritty man. My socks are not at all clean. That's the lifestyle I live. It's right on the edge of cleanliness, of hygiene, and I like to manifest that in my books as well.
But you would say that you're the grittiest man on the floor here.
I would say, yeah, it's a really kind of scrubbed floor. It's kind of nauseating almost, so I'm just trying to bring some grit.
Well, what do you have coming up the pipeline? What books are you working on? What books are coming out, etc.? Tell me.
How far in the future are you interested? A month or 6 months? Right now we have a new one coming out in a couple weeks called Icelander, which is sort of this Agatha Christie meets Vladimir Nabokov, sort of this weird romp with all this Icelandic lore and sort of Ethan Hawke type is kind of a character. And
Ethan Hawke's in this?
Sort of. We changed his name to Nathan for a little.
Nathan Falcon?
He's unnamed. Unnamed Generation X actor. Anyway, it's sort of a romp. It's a romp for people who like romps. And then this fall, we have The Children's Hospital by Chris Adrian, which we believe should be big. I'm doing a large gesture right now.
And it is quite a large gesture,
yes,
I should report.
It's enormous. It cannot be contained on podcasts. And that's by this guy, Chris Adrian, who we've published in the journal before. And he is both a doctor and a divinity student right now. And this book is about basically a Children's Hospital where the earth floods under 7 miles of water and the only thing remaining is this Children's Hospital floating on top. But it's not at all allegory, it's not at all a joke, it's super realist and hard-hitting and epic and amazing. It's a really exciting book.
This actually shares a little bit in common with the Yannick Murphy book, because that had a very surreal feel and yet it was drawn from her personal experience when I talked with her. Is this the kind of sort of, it seems to be a recurrent sort of motif here of the Eli, this attracts my eye kind of situation?
Well, I would say the thing they have in common and that Salvador Potenzio book they have in common is they're grounded in personal experience, whether it's autobiographical or just or other human experience, but really grounded in real emotion, real feeling, real stories, but not content to just sit tight with that and write about these real stories in the most obvious, simple way. So there's an attention to craft married to a sort of human content and deeper resonance. And that's definitely what we're trying for all our books, not mere style or plain old mere story, mere recognizable characters.
Gotcha.
So we can successfully unify that in a way that feels vital and real.
And why the Frankenstein thing on your head?
I thought it was Incredible Hulk.
Oh, it is the Hulk.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Hulk.
Yeah. I just saw the Marvel logo.
Just, sometimes it can, we're like the little guy in this big convention center.
Yeah.
So this can give me a little personal inner strength.
This is allegory drawn from personal experience.
If I feel a little intimidated by, we're right near Houghton Mifflin and all these dudes, I just pop down the mask, and Hulk smash.
Gotcha. Well, Eli, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Me llaman el desaparecido, cuando llega ya se ha ido, volando vengo, volando voy, deprisa, rumbo perdido, cuando me buscan nunca estoy, cuando me encuentran yo no soy, el que está enfrente porque ya me fui corriendo más allá, me dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está, me dicen el desagradecido, pero esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo un dolor que no me deja respirar. Llevo en el cuerpo una condena que siempre me echa a caminar. Me dicen el desaparecido que cuando llega ya se ha ido. Hola.